This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Hello and welcome to NewsHour from the BBC World Service, coming to you live from London with me, Sean Lay. The collision between a civilian plane and a US Army helicopter in the sky over Washington DC on Wednesday night resulted in 67 people dying in the sub-zero temperatures of the Potomac River. At a White House news conference Thursday lunchtime, the US President Donald Trump led reporters in a moment of silence for the dead and then reflected the shock many in the United States are feeling.
This was a dark and excruciating night in our nation's capital and in our nation's history, and a tragedy of terrible proportions. As one nation, we grieve for every precious soul that has been taken from us so suddenly, and we are a country of really, we are in mourning. This is really shaking a lot of people, including people, very sadly, from other nations who were on the flight. For the family members back in Wichita, Kansas, here in Washington, D.C., and throughout the United States and in Russia, whose loved ones were aboard the passenger jet, we can only begin to imagine the agony that you're all feeling. Nothing worse. On behalf of the First Lady, myself, and 340 million Americans, our hearts are shattered alongside yours, and our prayers are with you now. And in the days to come, we'll be working very, very diligently in the days to come. We're here for you to wipe away the tears and to offer you our devotion, our love, and our support.
The president then gave his opinion on what may have caused the collision.
We must have only the highest standards for those who work in our aviation system. I changed the Obama standards from very mediocre at best to extraordinary. And then when I left office and Biden took over, he changed them back to lower than ever before. I put safety first. Obama, Biden, and the Democrats put policy first.
President Trump was challenged by reporters at the press conference who asked whether he was blaming the air traffic controllers on duty or prejudging the investigation itself. Mr. Trump insisted he wasn't doing so, but he then questioned why the airplane and the helicopter were flying at the same altitude.
We do know that you had two planes at the same level. You had a helicopter and a plane. That shouldn't have happened. And we'll see. We're going to look into that and we're going to see. But certainly for an air traffic controller, we want the brightest, the smartest, the sharpest. We want somebody that's psychologically superior. And that's what we're going to have.
Well, Naomi Iqbal is the BBC's North America correspondent. She's been at Reagan Airport following reaction to the events last night. The National Transportation and Safety Board gave a news conference a short time ago, and I asked Naomi to tell us what was happening.
They are giving us more information as they get it on exactly, you know, what's happened. But look, this investigation is very much in its very, very early stages. The recovery effort is still going on. I'm in Ronald Reagan Airport and I could just see out into the main runway. And, you know, when you get closer, you can see investigators out on the tarmac near the River Potomac. The bodies haven't been recovered yet, but you know, you played some of the press conference of Donald Trump, who the president has already seemingly prejudged the investigation before it's even started, less known concluded.
The National Transportation Board saying there'll be no speculation from it of the crash cause. Do we have any indication of how long the investigation itself might take?
Not clear. I mean, they have said it could take days or weeks. They're just not sure at this stage. This will, you know, involve so many agencies coming together. They have to also work with the military to find out what went wrong. So at this stage, we don't have a timeline.
There are reports that staffing was not normal last night. Do we know any more about those claims?
Yeah, there have been, you know, the concerns that the staffing has been low, and they have struggled to sort of
the FAA fill these vacancies. But I think it'll also, there'll be renewed questions about safety in the US aviation industry. I mean, you often see military and Coast Guard helicopters flying low over the river. They share the skies with planes that are constantly taking off and landing here at Reagan National Airport. The National Airport was actually built to handle around 15 million passengers annually. It now handles, I think, around more than 20 million. And so there will be questions asked about that. I mean, there are so many questions, yes, that haven't been answered about this. It's worth mentioning that major incidents of this kind are relatively rare in the US as well. The most recent comparable crash was in 2009.
What about the president's suggestion that the diversity policy of the previous administration may in some way have contributed? What's been the reaction to that?
Well, look, Donald Trump is less than 2 weeks into his presidency. This is a huge national tragedy that he's been confronted with, and he's bypassed the usual playbook, and we expect that from him. Without waiting for a full investigation or a list of the victims, mind you, he's started to point fingers and pushed for his political agenda. But the truth is, we don't know exactly what caused this crash, and we are waiting to find out, which will take some time.
That's the BBC's Nomia Iqbal. Well, Peter Goles is the former managing director of the US National Transportation Safety Board. And earlier he told me what America's recent aviation safety record had been like.
America has had an extraordinary run of safe flight. The last accident we had was accident known as the Colgan crash, and it happened, you know, in 2009. So this has been a great run for the United States. So that made this accident all the more shocking and all the more high pressure.
What do you make of what you have heard so far about the circumstances of last night's collision?
You know, I know this area very well. It is the most congested airspace in the country. You have Reagan National Airport, or DCA, which is a flight-controlled, slot-controlled airport. It is very crowded. And then you have military flights, which are flying at lower levels, helicopters, almost constantly as well. So it is a very complex and crowded airspace. There have been close calls in the past in terms of mid-airs, but there has been no accidents.
We heard some of the conversation between the air traffic control and the Army helicopter just before the collision. It appeared to be warning that it was getting potentially dangerously close to the aircraft. What did you take from that conversation? Well, or at least what are the questions that it prompts?
Well, clearly the investigation is going to zero in on where the two aircrafts were in the airspace. Were they there because they were ordered to be there? Were they at the accurate height? Were they going at the recorded speed? The investigators need to know that the planes were in their assigned spaces. My guess is at least one of the planes, probably the Black Hawk, was outside of their airspace.
There is some suggestion that air traffic control may have switched the runway on which the civilian plane was landing, and that might have confused the helicopter's pilot. Is that a possibility?
It certainly is a possibility, and it would be hard to know because the Black Hawk helicopter does not have a voice recorder. So we won't know what the flight crew were thinking and talking, unlike the commercial airline, which has both a voice recorder and a data recorder. But the idea of switching the runway, that happens virtually every day, numerous times a day.
And seeking verbal confirmation from a pilot, that also is a relatively common?
Yes, absolutely.
Let's talk, if we may, about the news conference the president gave a little earlier today. A couple of points that come out of that. One kind of technical point, if perhaps we could just deal with, is he expressed concern that both aircraft appeared to be flying at the same height at the point of collision. Is that in itself something that would be surprising, given that one was landing?
Well, that press conference was appalling, and it served to undercut aviation safety, the reputation of American aviation safety that has been built up over 40 years. The idea of trying to identify this as a DEI-generated accident.
That's a diversity Obama, hiring policy, yeah.
That's right. With President Obama at fault, was really appalling. And I think we have no idea at this point whether the two aircraft are at the same altitude or assigned to the same altitude. It's premature. And much of what the president said was premature and perhaps wrong.
Does that affect the investigation in any way, the intervention that he's made today? I mean, you say it's kind of potentially damaging, but I wonder if in practical terms it has an impact on what the investigators do next.
The investigators are immune from politics. Mm. However, I have to underscore that all of them, or many of them, at the agency received the potential termination or buyout letter issued by the administration 2 days ago. So there was great turmoil taking place. The president ought to act like every previous president, support the independence of the NTSB, let them get the job done, and then act on their, see that the executive branch acts on their recommendations to make people safer.
Can I just press you on this diversity question? And I tell you why I do it, because more than one of the administration voices who took part in that news conference today raised it. And they did so because their argument appeared to be that, for example, some people had not been hired because of the colour of their skin, basically, and that that had contributed to a shortfall, for example, in the number of air traffic controllers being trained. Is there any kind of basis to support that claim, of which you are aware, and I appreciate your knowledge of this may be limited?
Yeah, I am unaware of any evidence that supports that qualified controllers were denied access to training and employment. We have a shortage of controllers. We are vigorously recruiting controllers, potential controllers across the country. So, no, I'm not aware of that.
Just on that question of shortage of controllers, New York Times reported a couple of years ago on near misses in U.S. aviation. Has the system been under strain because of the shortage, would you say?
The system has been under strain for probably 20 years, a combination of increased traffic, congestion at airports, and a slowdown in the introduction of new technologies that would make flying safer.
So in other words, the government needs to invest.
The government needs to invest, and the government needs to support innovation.
That was Peter Goles, who was the managing director of the National Transportation Safety Board. And the current board member, Todd Inman, told a news conference this evening, "We don't yet know enough facts to be able to rule in or out human factor or mechanical error." This is News Hour from the BBC World Service. Coming up, Marianne Faithfull, the singer and actor, has died.
You must leave now, take what you need, you think will last.
We'll be hearing about her life and career a little later in the programme. Let me also give you an update on our headlines this hour. And we have news from rest of the world in the course of this hour, including reports from Rwanda and on the release of Israel hostages held by Hamas and of Palestinian prisoners held by Israel. All coming up on NewsHour on the BBC World Service. This is NewsHour from the BBC World Service, live from London with me, Sean Lay. Now to Germany, arguably the most important country in the European Union, but also one currently suffering political turmoil. The bitter collapse of the ruling coalition before Christmas has paralysed government. The parties vying to lead Germany after next month's election are fighting not just each other, but increasingly influential parties from the fringe. So today's condemnation by Angela Merkel, Germany's longest-serving chancellor since the Second World War, of the current leader of the CDU, the party she led for so many years, is striking. As we discussed on NewsHour yesterday, the CDU's candidate to be Chancellor, Friedrich Merz, put forward proposals on immigration which passed the Bundestag, but only with the votes of MPs from the AfD, the Alternative für Deutschland. It's a party which is seen as toxic by the main parties who refuse to work with it. Mrs. Merkel, though, posting on her website, wrote, "It's wrong to no longer feel bound by this proposal and thus, for the first time, to have deliberately allowed on January the 29th a majority with the votes of the AfD in a vote in the German Bundestag." The current Chancellor, Olaf Scholz, was quick to voice his anger that Merz would break the so-called firewall and benefit from support for the far-right party.
Sie nehmen die Unterstützung der AfD für ihre rechtswidrigen Vorschläge offen in Kauf.
They accept the support of the AfD for their unlawful proposals. You are supporting those who fight our democracy, who despise our united Europe, who have been poisoning the climate in our country for years. That is a grave mistake, an unforgivable mistake.
Olaf Scholz, while Katja Hoyer is an historian and author of Beyond the Wall, East Germany 1949-1990. As to what the context is to Mrs. Merkel's intervention, particularly to explain the firewall and why people are worried that yesterday's vote might undermine it.
Angela Merkel's intervention really is quite a rare thing. She hasn't spoken much about politics or intervened much basically since she retired in 2021. So this is quite significant, but it's also her legacy that is at stake here. So really the sort of widespread anti-immigration sentiment that has been growing in the German population came out of her decision in 2015 to respond to the refugee crisis then by basically opening the borders. And so, you know, what is happening now is effectively her party reversing her own policies. So she clearly felt the need to come out and comment on that.
Mr. Merz insists that he remains opposed to the AfD's involvement in any level of government. He won't work with them. The motion contained lots of criticism of them. But in the end, he did rely on votes and arguably merely to gain a symbolic victory, since this policy, although passed by the Bundestag, won't become law.
Yeah, I mean, the problem that he has is that effectively the Conservatives are the only mainstream party that sort of sit right off centre and are effectively a Conservative party. So for people who want immigration to be limited, and the surveys indicate that that's about 2/3 of the population right now, he's the only vehicle really outside the far right, you know, to do that. Mm. So in terms of finding allies for that, he'd have to look further left on the political spectrum, and both the Green Party and the centre-left SPD have sort of said that they wouldn't go ahead with, you know, with the proposals that he's put forward. So he's accepting effectively, you know, the votes of the far right in order to do something that he thinks the majority of the population want.
Is it a risk for him politically?
It is a risk in the sense that it makes coalition building after the election in February more difficult, because he's already ruled out a coalition with the far right. So that,
and we should, sorry to interrupt, we should be clear that at the moment the polling is suggesting that the CDU is ahead, but the AfD is the party in second place at the moment.
Absolutely, and it makes it quite difficult for him to build any kind of majority really with any party right now. If you rule out the right, you know, the far right effectively, and the left-wing parties have just said that they're really, you know, objecting to what he's just done, it means that he's burnt a lot of bridges. But at the same time, the Conservatives have been losing votes for years now, because people feel that they're not conservative enough anymore. So he needs to reestablish, you know, a kind of centre-right option for people
just
as well.
And just briefly, you don't think he'd be worried that he might lose centrist voters who've supported the CDU?
It's possible, but as I said, the surveys seem to indicate that about 2/3 of the public want the things. I mean, there was one that came out today that asked people specifically on the law that he's just put out. So I would imagine that a lot of these centrist people agree with the policy, even if they're uneasy about using far-right votes for it.
That's Katja Hoyer on recent events in Germany. I'm Still Here, a Brazilian film, is making waves ahead of the Oscars next month. Not only is it breaking box office records, it's been nominated in the Best Picture category, a first for a Brazilian movie in Portuguese. As Tom Brook reports from New York, for many Brazilians at home and abroad, I'm Still Here touches a raw nerve.
Oh, The film I'm Still Here is set in Brazil in the 1970s, when the country was living under a military dictatorship.
Anda, anda!
Nós vamos sorrir.
At the centre of this story, based on real events, is Onisi Paiva, played by Fernanda Torres, whose seemingly joyous family life is changed forever when her husband Rubens, a former leftist congressman, disappears after he is apprehended by the military.
Não, não tem engano nenhum, não. O senhor vem com a gente.
In Brazil, the film has been a big box office success and it's brought the country its first ever Oscar Best Picture nomination for a film in Portuguese. As well as nominations for Best International Feature and for Fernanda Torres for Best Actress. It's a big shot in the arm for Brazilian cinema. Rodrigo Brandão is a Brazilian filmmaker.
This is really about a topic that people are talking about on the streets right now. What is the value of democracy? You know, should we fight for democracy in Brazil? And so this film really captures that.
The film was launched at the Venice Film Festival last year, where top Brazilian filmmaker Walter Salles explained how he was moved to tell the story of Onisi Paiva's response to her husband's forced, violent disappearance.
It was an extraordinary story of a family enduring an act of violence and with a woman redefining herself in the middle of it. I fell in love with that woman.
Junta! Vai, Rubens!
That woman is Onisi Paiva, played by Fernanda Torres, who's now a strong Oscar contender. But the actor's chances of winning may have been weakened because a comedy sketch from 20 years ago, in which she appeared in blackface, recently resurfaced. She has apologized, stating that when she performed the sketch, the racist history of blackface hadn't yet entered mainstream consciousness in Brazil. Torres maintains that in I'm Still Here, she tried to stay truthful to her character who prevailed in the wake of her husband's disappearance to emerge as an activist for the rights of indigenous people.
That's what we tried, I think, to be faithful to this woman that believed that the way to fight against dictatorship and authoritarianism was through education and justice.
I'm Still Here has also been embraced enthusiastically by audiences and critics outside Brazil. In the Brazilian community in Astoria, New York, there's a great sense of pride that Brazilian cinema has been recognized by the Academy's 10,000 Oscar voters.
For us, it's like the World Cup. It's amazing. We're very proud and happy.
It's so nice to see that my country is being recognized for such a critical situation in Brazil.
Quite apart from its political themes, the film is important to Brazilians for sentimental reasons. The film's leading lady, Fernanda Torres, appears in a picture which also features a performance from Fernanda Montenegro, her 95-year-old mother. 25 years ago, she was nominated for Best Actress at the Oscars but lost to Gwyneth Paltrow. So now the country is rooting for her daughter to make history and finally bring home the Oscars gold to Brazil.
Tom Brooks reporting, and they won't have long to wait because the 97th Annual Academy Awards, the Oscars as they're known, will be awarded on Sunday, March the 2nd. This is NewsHour. Let's return to our top story. The collision over Washington's Reagan National Airport last night. Three people on board a military helicopter died, as did all 64 on a commercial flight. That flight had originated in Wichita in Kansas. We're joined now by the mayor of Wichita, Lily Wu. Thank you very much for being with us on NewsHour. This must have been a terrible 24 hours for your city.
Thank you, Sean. And it really has been a very tragic last 24 hours. We started at the airport yesterday and have continued to come to City Hall. We just held a community-wide prayer here in the City Council chambers and then went outside. What we're asking from the entire global community is that you pray for all the individuals who were lost and honor the families who are grieving. And I'm really asking all of our communities to come together here in Wichita as Wichitans, as Kansans, and as Americans.
The ice skating competition that took place at the Wichita Ice Center was a major event. Presumably it must have involved a lot of young people.
It was such an honor to host the U.S. Figure Skating Championships last week. We got to meet some of those skaters, their families, their coaches and fans. We were so proud to have hosted this national championship and to know that there were several individuals on that flight from the skating community breaks our hearts. I know that many of our community members became friends with these individuals, and they are truly mourning the loss of these new relationships they just had, and our entire community is grieving.
Is it difficult for them in particular? Because so far, I understand American Eagle that operated the flight has not yet released the manifest, the list of passengers who were on board.
That is correct. I've been in touch with American Airlines since last night, and unfortunately, they do not release the manifest. So as of right now, all the information that we have are just a number of individuals. And I really want to respect the process, which is to notify families first. And I believe that that is a prudent and respectful thing to do first and foremost. And so right now, I want to make sure that families and next of kin are contacted.
I should just ask you in the last 30 seconds or so, are you at all concerned that some of the national political voices are at risk of prejudging this crash?
Right now, what I'm doing with the council is really trying to unite our community around the individuals who've been impacted by this tragedy. We have family members here in Wichita who were directly affected, and what we need to do here in our community is first and foremost provide words of comfort and words that unite and actions that really help families.
Mayor Lily Wu, thank you so much for joining us from Wichita, Kansas at this difficult time for you and for your city. This is NewsHour from the BBC World Service with me, Sean Lay. In Israel, the release today of Palestinian detainees as part of the ceasefire with Hamas was delayed as Israel protested at the chaotic scenes surrounding the release of 7 hostages this morning. Among those released today, 5 Thai nationals. They were working on farms when they were abducted during the Hamas attack on the 7th of October 2023. In all, 44 Thai citizens were either killed that day or died subsequently in captivity. One remains unaccounted for. He's believed held by Hamas but has not yet been released. Most of them came to Israel attracted by higher wages in agriculture there than that which can be earned at home. Wewaro Sayoan, the mother of one of the released hostages, Wachara Sayoan, was watching a live stream of a vehicle moving slowly through a cheering crowd in Gaza when she spoke to the BBC.
We've been waiting for over a year, hoping and praying for him to come back to us. This is what we've been praying for every day. In the end, there was no warning, nothing to prepare us for this. A couple of days ago, there was no sign. But when we spoke to the church clerk, they said, it won't be long now. It won't be long before there's good news.
Well, after their release, they were taken by helicopter to the Shamir Medical Center near Tel Aviv, where a larger group of Thai hostages released in late 2023 were also treated. The hostages today were met by the chief executive, Dr. Osna Levzion Koric. Earlier, she told me about their condition.
Seemingly, weight-wise, they look okay. Of course, the way we treat it is we don't ask at all penetrating questions. The idea is to let them regain their control on their lives. 15 months, there were someone else decided for them everything they did. They called their families back in Thailand because the families are not here, and our connection with the Thai embassy is very close. We need to remember that there is a language barrier because they don't speak not Hebrew and not English. Although we do have a psychologist in Israel who is married to a Thai lady, and he speaks fluent Thai, and he's helping. He helped us last time, and he's helping us as well.
Can you give me a sense of, without intruding on the privacy of the conversation, some sense of the atmosphere, the emotions for those men when they were talking to their families back home after such a long time when indeed their families weren't even certain that they were still alive?
Correct. So it was very exciting. Of course, I was not at the phone calls, but everyone's extremely happy, and the ambassador and here as well. I mean, the whole hospital went outside to clap them and wave flags. We brought flags of the Israeli and Thai flags. And we are at days where the whole nation is not breathing out of excitement and as well as fear, because we don't know what to expect. And we need to remember that we still have 83 hostages back in Gaza that yeah. we need to release.
And, of course, there is one Thai hostage currently unaccounted for, and presumably there is still a family in Thailand waiting to hear what has happened to that man. Let's talk a bit, if we may, about what you learnt from dealing with that large group of Thais back in 2023. Were there things that you had not been expecting, maybe had not planned for, things that you changed as a result of working with them to reflect their needs?
Yes. So, for example, the small thing of whether they want to be in a single room or in the double room. Mm-hmm. So the last time we organized a single room, and then they came and they said, no, we don't want to be by ourselves. So we changed it. So this time we have the options of either being in a single room or in a double room. The way they eat, you know, so now there's rice on the menu, morning, lunch, mm-hmm. and dinner. The other thing is what I said before is that because they're very obedient and very, of course, it's just generalization, but yes. So when you speak and you want to give them their back to regain control over their lives, you don't want to intrude you have to be very, very soft and very not demanding, because otherwise they would just say whatever you want them to say. So
rather than what they need to say, because you want to be led by them.
Really feel exactly because they want to be, you know, they want to please us. So they just arrived here. Overall, they seem very, very happy to be here, to be safe. You know, for them, they cannot cope and grasp why they were in captivity for 15 months. You know, there were some of them came to Israel only a few days before October 7th, and they saw their friends murdered, and they were taken hostages. You know, it's crazy. It's really unbelievable.
Dr. Osnat Levzion-Koric. I asked the BBC's Nick Beek in Jerusalem to explain the choreography of today's releases and how things nearly went awry.
So what happened was the Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, along with other prominent politicians, were very, very quick to come out with condemnation of what we saw in the southern Gazan city of Khan Yunis. And this focused on the release in particular of Arbel Yehud, who's a 29-year-old civilian. And the images everyone saw, was this woman on her own. She was surrounded by dozens and dozens of armed men from Hamas and also from Palestinian Islamic Jihad. And it was chaotic. At one point it looked like there was going to be a crush. There was no coordination. And it was in stark contrast to some of the very, you know, clearly choreographed parts of the hostage releases that Hamas has previously organized. And so as a result of this, Israel said they were delaying the release of these 110 Palestinian prisoners. But after a few hours, it seems that with the help of mediators, some sort of deal was done, and those 110 prisoners were released.
And what can you tell us about the detainees who were freed by the Israelis?
Yes, so of the 110 today, about 30 were in prison for the most serious offences. In the eyes of the Israelis, they had some figures who were key militants in groups in the West Bank. They had been convicted of carrying out attacks in which Israelis had been killed. There are also 30 children as part of this, the youngest being 15 years old, some women as well. Also pointing out some of those hadn't been convicted of anything, but were people who'd been detained. So there was joy for their families in Ramallah, other places in the West Bank as they were returning. We were told that about 20 people would be deported because of the severity of their crimes. So there was jubilation there, and clearly jubilation in Israel too, as these 8 hostages, the 3 Israelis and 5 Thais, were freed as well.
And as you say, some of the Palestinian detainees presumably were people who'd been picked up by the Israelis relatively recently.
Yes, that's right. I mean, there's as part of this, there's a sort of mathematical equation that comes into this very delicate ceasefire arrangement that is progressing. For example, for every civilian hostage that's released, that means that 30 Palestinian prisoners are to be freed. And for every Israeli soldier, that equates under this system to 50 Palestinian detainees. And so this is the formula that's being followed. Although worth pointing out, Sean, that in terms of the five Thai hostages who were released today, that was a separate agreement.
Right.
And there were no Palestinian prisoners released as part of that.
You know, just last thought. I mean, you know, the ceasefire, this stage is supposed to last 6 weeks. There were obviously signs this is not the first of kind of conflict, and it's looked a bit rocky. I mean, what are the prospects of it lasting? Never mind getting beyond the first stage.
Yes, I think today underscored just how difficult it is. Three more hostages due to be released on Saturday, but worth pointing out that we haven't reached the day 16 mark. So, that comes in at the start of next week. That's when the big discussions about the future of Gaza take place. So a lot of people think, actually, this is the relatively straightforward part.
Nick Beek in Jerusalem. It's a painting of a fisherman smoking a pipe. Good enough for a punter rummaging through the contents of a garage sale in Minnesota to cough up $50 for it. But the insurance could end up being quite a bit more. Some art experts think the canvas was painted by the 19th century Dutch artist Vincent van Gogh, in which case it would be worth not $50, but $15 million. But that requires authentication by Amsterdam's Van Gogh Museum. It examines such claims only by invitation because applications reached 500 a year at one point. And given the artist's short and troubled life, you can perhaps understand any official scepticism over claims that I've got an unknown Van Gogh at home. Jennifer Mass, founder and president of Scientific Analysis of Fine Art, a company that provides artwork authentication and attribution, is one of the experts assembled by LMI, an art research firm which hopes this work is genuine. NewsHour's James Menendez asked Jennifer the $64 million question, or perhaps that should be the $50 million question. Does she think the painting is by Vincent van Gogh?
Well, I have been working on this painting for 3 years now, and in general, it is my role to have data and not necessarily have an opinion. But after spending 30 years, my entire career, looking at works of art, of course, I do have an opinion. And I have to say that I started out appropriately scientifically skeptical, and in literally the past month or so, I am starting to feel quite positive, quite confident about this work.
Okay. that's pretty good going. What happens then? So you and the other experts put forward a dossier of what you think is the evidence, and then who decides? Is it the Van Gogh Museum who has the final say?
So traditionally in the art market, there'll be, you know, one or two art historians that will be the deciders, that every painting has to go before them. And yes, the Van Gogh Museum has played that role, absolutely. And in some sense, their job, very appropriately, is to always say no, because they are really protecting his reputation and our understanding of the history of his work. But they have changed their minds over time. And it's all a matter of the information that we can present the museum with, just so we can go beyond connoisseurship, which is absolutely critical. And none of the technology and science that we do is ever going to replace the connoisseurship. But it is also critical in terms of coming up with a positive attribution. And so the LMI group that I'm working with, they are profoundly data-driven. And so the type of materials data that I collect and techniques on the paintings, that's just part of the data that we're collecting on an artwork.
Jennifer, just in the last sort of 40 seconds we've got, I mean, if it does turn out to be genuine, how significant would this be? I mean, it's quite a find, isn't it?
It absolutely is. And I think what's fascinating about Van Gogh is that he's done approximately 900 paintings, and yet in the public eye, we get to see the same, you know, 70 to 100 paintings over and over again. And there's so much more to the artist than that. And so this painting, while it might look unusual, for example, compared to Starry Night, it actually fits in perfectly with what he was doing in this particular point in his career, turning back to the earlier palette he used in the Netherlands.
That's Jennifer Mass talking to James Menendez here on NewsHour from the BBC World Service. On this programme yesterday, Belgium's foreign minister told me he would press fellow EU foreign ministers to consider cutting aid to Rwanda. That's because of its support for the M23 rebel group, which is currently menacing eastern Congo. Today, the French foreign minister Jean-Noël Barrot met the president of DR Congo before travelling to Rwanda's capital Kigali to urge its president, Paul Kagame, to withdraw his troops. Mr. Barrot also demanded an immediate withdrawal from Congolese territory by the M23 group itself. Its response, we will continue the march of liberation all the way to Kinshasa. Kinshasa is Congo's capital and the seat of government. Well, earlier I spoke to Roland Machal, a researcher at the Centre for International Studies at Sciences Po in Paris. He focuses on economies and conflicts in sub-Saharan Africa. And I asked him what Mr. Barrot is hoping to achieve.
I think he's trying to put in place a mediation and appear as the country able to talk to both main protagonists in order to avoid a regional war.
There is clearly a view, we heard it expressed on this programme by the Belgian foreign minister last night, a view in European capitals that Rwanda is stoking this crisis. Is France in a particular place to exercise influence over Rwanda?
Yes, indeed. The relations with Paul Kagame are good. As you know, President Macron commissioned a report on the French involvement in the genocide. This report was very clear on certain responsibilities shared by the French cabinet. And of course, there is the issue of North Mozambique, the fight against a jihadi group, which is as well the way to secure the exploration and exploitation of massive oil and gas reserve in that part of Mozambique.
Jean-Noël Barrot, the French foreign minister, on his visit today said that the M23 rebels should immediately withdraw from the territory of DR Congo. The group spokeswoman responded by saying, we won't withdraw, we're going to march on Kinshasa. I mean, that doesn't sound a very promising start for any mediating role, particularly as many countries have offered evidence to suggest that Rwanda is really the controlling influence on the M23's activities.
Yeah, okay. You have two attitudes. One is to say, okay, we need the mediation. The two mediation processes that exist today have failed. Therefore, we need a third one. France tried to show that it's able to carry out this duty. That's one attitude. The other one, as you said, is we see how Rwanda's forces are entrenched in the eastern DRC. We see how ambitious and actually bitter Paul Kagame has been over the last days responding to international criticism against the presence of his troops officially in the eastern DRC. The chance of success is very thin. It doesn't mean that a mediation shouldn't be tried.
If it fails, we heard from the Belgian foreign minister on this programme yesterday that whilst Belgium wouldn't do it bilaterally, it would press other European countries to collectively consider suspending aid to Rwanda. That appeared to work back in 2012 in encouraging some disengagement, some reduction of the violence. Could it work this time?
Time is the main parameter. If you suspend aid, how long it is going to take to be felt in Kigali, and what is the time frame of strategic military operation in the DRC. I think France, of course, is trying to find an alternative. I personally doubt that is going to be successful, but you need to give some time to the French. And of course, we could raise concern on the fact that France is playing alone. Paris hasn't been trying to mobilize other European countries that are closely associated to the current crisis in DRC, such as Belgium. But again, let us assume that we need a few days to see whether the French diplomatic discourse is just empty, as it happened to be in other situations, or whether France is actually able to move things and to get some military development that will be congruent with a ceasefire, maybe confidence building, and so on and so forth.
That's Roland Marchal, a researcher at the Centre for International Studies at Sciences Po in Paris. The actress and singer Marianne Faithfull has died at the age of 78. She was just a teenager when she became one of the faces and voices of London in the swinging 60s. Thanks in part to a song written for her by the Rolling Stones' Mick Jagger and Keith Richards. Her career, though, was compromised by her 20-year-long battle with drugs. David Siliso looks back at her life.
It is the evening of the day.
Marianne Faithfull. In the 60s, she was a star. She had a run of chart hits. She was Mick Jagger's girlfriend. She was one of the in crowd. But that golden era didn't last long. Marianne Faithfull described her childhood as like living in a Renoir painting. Her family were bohemian, but school was strict. However, everything changed when the startlingly beautiful 17-year-old met the Rolling Stones and their manager, Andrew Loog Oldham.
I went to a party. The Rolling Stones were there, and I was looking very shabby. And they came up and said to the person I was with, "And can she sing?" And they had a conversation over my head, and then they arranged where I was to be, and I went there.
And you recorded as Tears Go By?
Yes.
I sit and watch as tears go by.
30 years later, she talked of how she had secretly hoped that the record would fail.
Because I had a vague idea that if this was a hit, all hell would break loose. This all went on in my summer holidays. So I was just thinking I'd got away with it and I would go back to school and get on with my A-levels. And then in October, it took off. And that was that.
The image of shy, wistful 60s innocence was shattered, though, when she was caught up in a drugs raid on Keith Richards' home. The lurid and false headlines about her left deep wounds. By the 70s, she was a heroin addict, but she continued to record and in the mid-80s quit drugs.
It is the evening of the day.
You could hear the darkness, the cracks and scars of those years in her music. She had endured more than her share of the era's sexism, but the artist that emerged was, she said, no one's victim. And you could hear it all in this, a re-recording of her most famous song.
As tears go by.
Proud, unapologetic, the voice of Marianne Faithfull.
Da, da, da.
David Siliso reporting on Marianne Faithfull, who's died at the age of 78. Sir Mick Jagger posted, "She was a wonderful friend, a beautiful singer and a great actress." And Ronnie Wood posted on social media a photograph of Marianne Faithfull in the studio with him and with Keith Richards. Appended to it the words, "Farewell, dear Marianne." This has been NewsHour. Thank you so much for your company. I'm Sean Lay.
Yoga is more than just exercise. It's the spiritual practice that millions swear by. And in 2017, Miranda, a university tutor from London, joins a yoga school that promises profound transformation.
It felt a really safe and welcoming space. After the yoga classes, I felt amazing.
But soon, that calm, welcoming atmosphere leads to something far darker, a journey that leads to allegations of grooming, trafficking and exploitation across international borders.
I don't have my passport, I don't have my phone, I don't have my bank cards, I have nothing.
The passport being taken, the being in a house and not feeling like they can leave.
World of Secrets is where untold stories are unveiled and hidden realities are exposed. In this new series, we're confronting the dark side of the wellness industry, where the hope of a spiritual breakthrough gives way to disturbing accusations.
You just get sucked in so gradually, and it's done so skillfully that you don't realise.
And it's like this, the secret that's there. I wanted to believe that, you know, that whatever they were doing, even if it seemed gross to me, was for some spiritual reason that I couldn't yet understand.
Revealing the hidden secrets of a global yoga network.
I feel that I have no other choice. The only thing I can do is to speak about this and to put my reputation and everything else on the line. I want truth and justice. And for other people to not be hurt. For things to be different in the future.
to bring it into the light and almost alchemize some of that evil stuff that went on and take back the power.
World of Secrets, Season 6, The Bad Guru. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.